We talked this morning about the Bible and about the facts that are shown to be proven true despite skeptics' claims that there was contradictions between what history is and what the Bible actually said. I'd like to continue that theme, but I want to focus more on not so much the things that people doubted about the Bible, but just some evidence that shows that what the Bible is saying is actually true. Because mankind's memories about the past are poor. After all, we didn't live in the past. Most of us didn't. I get really concerned when I start reading in history books of things I remember. But it starts to make me feel like I'm old. But there, you know, prior to our lifetime, we don't have any personal memories of it. Yeah, we know some of the things our parents tell us or our grandparents tell us. But then it starts kind of trickling out. We don't know much about what happened in the past. And in general, we don't keep extensive records. And those records we do keep are often on materials that don't last. Sure, you did your first grade, you know, homework on paper and pencil. I doubt many of you have it around anymore. Maybe mom kept a couple pieces. But most of it's gone. Now, you know, start multiplying that by 100 years, 200 years, 500 years. The paper is going to wear out. It's going to get brittle. It's going to fall apart. People don't care anymore. They say, what's this junk? And they toss it out. And so we don't have extensive records about the past. And archaeology is basically a branch of science that attempts to bring that past to light, even though we don't have a lot to work with. And archaeology is of interest to the students of the Bible, but it cannot prove that the Bible is true or false. You need to keep that in mind. Archaeology by itself cannot prove the truth or the falsity of the Bible, because the records are way too incomplete to make any strong statements. Yet it can provide supporting information to what the Bible teaches and says. And a lot of the archaeological finds you'll find are filled with doubts. People are constantly questioning even what they find and what that means. Yet there are many people who are seeking to disprove the Bible by seeking proof in archaeology. And what you'll find is if they don't believe in the Bible and they find some archaeological claim, you know what they end up with when they get done? They still don't believe in the Bible. And if they do believe in the Bible and they find some archaeological claims, guess what? They still believe in it. In other words, it really doesn't change people's views. Not for the most part. But what's interesting is the amount of confirming information that's out there is actually staggering. You know, I won't be able to cover even a small portion of it. But we want to, and I did a portion this morning, and we're going to do a portion this evening. And we still could go on and on thereafter, but I'm not going to. So don't get worried about it. But let's talk about one that's found in 2 Kings chapter 12. 2 Kings chapter 12. And we're going to start with verse 4. It says, then Jehoash said to the priests, all the money of the sacred things which is brought into the house of the Lord is current in current money, both the money of each man's assessment and all the money which may the heart any man's heart prompts him to bring into the house of the Lord. Let the priests take it for themselves and each of from his acquaintance, and they shall repair the damages of the house, whether any damage may be found. But it came about that in the 23rd year of King Jehoash, the priests had not repaired the damages of the house. Then King Jehoash called for Jehoiada, the priest, and for all the other priests, and said to them, why do you not repair the damages of the house? Now, therefore, take no more money from your acquaintances, but pay it for the damages of the house. And so the priests agreed that they would take no more of the money from the people, nor repair the damages of the house. But Jehoiada, the priest, took a chest and bore a hole in it in his lid and put it beside the altar on the right side as one comes into the house of the Lord, and the priest who guarded the threshold put it on all the money that was brought into the house of the Lord. And when he saw that there was much money in the chest, the king's scribe and the high priest came up and tied it in bags and counted the money which was found in the house of the Lord. And they gave the money which was weighed out into the hands of those who did the work, who had oversight over the house of the Lord. And it paid out it out to the carpenters and the builders who worked on the house of the Lord, and the masons and the stone cutters, and for buying timber and hewed stone to repair the damages to the house of the Lord. For all of it was laid out for the house of the, house to be repaired. But there were not made for the house of the Lord silver cups, snuffers, bowls, trumpets, and any vessels of gold or silver from the money which was brought into the house of the Lord. For they gave that to those who did the work, and with it they repaired the house of the Lord. Moreover, they did not require an accounting from the men into whom hand they had gave the money to pay to those who did the work, for they dealt faithfully. The money was from the guilt offering, and the money from the sin offering was not brought into the house of the Lord. It was for the priests. Now, this is what I have up on the board. You see a stone that was very, actually, for archaeology, this is actually a very recent find. It was found, at least brought out to light in 2003. So we're only talking about something about 11 years ago that somebody found. It was, when it was brought to light, it was very controversial. Still is somewhat controversial. Because when someone attempted to market the stone, the dealer refused to reveal the owner of who owned the stone before this dealer got a hold of it. And the reason for that is in Israel, where the stone was bought, owning an archaeological piece is illegal. And so the dealer was not going to reveal the guy's name because he would get jailed for it. But it does mean that the history of the stone can't be traced. And for archaeologists, that becomes something of suspicion when you don't know where it came from, because it's very ripe for forgeries. If it is a forgery, though, it's an incredibly accurate one. It passes every test currently known so far as material. It is made of sandstone. It has burn marks on it. It's been through fire. And what's got everybody excited is that if you examine it under a microscope, it has flecks of 1 micron size, very, 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 very tiny pieces of gold all across the surface. The reason that gets people excited because that means it matches as something that was overlaid with gold and then it was melted off in extreme heat, leaving just little flecks, little flecks across the surface. Now this would be very hard to forge, unless you're really intending to do it. In other words, they would have to actually made it, run it through a fire, get the ashes at the right carbon dating level, get cover it with gold, then melt it off in a fire. You know, the extreme heat. You know, there's a lot of things you would have to go through. Not only that, then the script that's there is ancient Hebrew script. It's not modern Hebrew script. It's an older form of Hebrew. And so they would have to be well acquainted with the older forms of how you write Hebrew as well. Now, one of the things, the reason we're interested in it, and I got the verse up here in 2 Kings chapter 24, I won't take time to read it, but when Nebuchadnezzar, after Joash had restored the temple, when Nebuchadnezzar weighed lace to Jerusalem, one of the things he did was take all the gold from the temple. And in a siege, it's not hard to imagine that there were fires and things like that. And so this might explain it. Most of the doubts don't center on the stone itself. Most people agree the stone is that old. But what has most people concerned is the words on the stone. See, the problem is that many scholars talk as if we know exactly the exact usage of Hebrew all throughout the ages. But the reality is we have very few samples of Hebrew. And the Bible remains our main source. And what's on this stone doesn't quite match what we just read in 2 Kings chapter 12. But it's really close. In fact, what it says, and I didn't have it written down here. I got it up on the board. It's kind of small to read. It says, I am Yahweh, the son of Jehoash, the son of Azariah, king of Judah. I performed the work on this house when men generously was full, men in the land and in the steep and in all the cities of Judah, giving consecrated money as a sacred donation abundantly to buy quarry stone and juniper wood and Edomitic copper, performing the work in good faith, that I made the repair of the temple and the encircling walls and the stone structure and the lattice work and the spiral staircase and the recesses and the doors, and this day will become a testimony to the work will prosper. May Yahweh ordain his people with blessing. Sound familiar? Now, you know, like I said, it doesn't match 2 Kings exactly. But then the problem is, if there's too many differences, it's oftentimes declared a fake because it doesn't match the current knowledge of the language. But if it's too exact, there's too few anomalies, then it's declared a fake because it's a copy from the Bible. And this one's somewhere in between. It's different, but it's not exactly the same. It looks like this is a commemorative plaque that Joash had put into the temple to say that they had repaired it. Matches what the Bible says. It's everything matches up, and as far as the dating and what you would expect to find, it's exactly what you expect. Yeah, there's some controversy over it, but I think it's going to stand the test of time in this one. Another one that we want to look at. It's in 2 Chronicles chapter 32. Assyria is a big, huge country, an empire up north of Judah and Israel. And the king of Assyria, Sennacherib, enters Judah. And we find this in 2 Chronicles 32 and verse 1. After these acts of faithfulness, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came and invaded Judah and besieged the fortified cities and thought to break into them for himself. Now, according to secular history, Sennacherib had recently come into power about this time, right after the death of Sargon II. At Sargon's death, revolts had broken out in various regions in the Assyrian Empire, and Sennacherib was determined to fully hold on to his vassal states. That oftentimes happens. The king who had full control over these outlying areas, well, he dies, and so everybody says, okay, the next king is not going to be as strong. He's not going to notice, and they all go in rebellion. And so one of the first things a lot of times the new kings have to do is go around and put everybody back into subject order. Knowing that Sennacherib would soon take a hand in putting Judah back under his power, Hezekiah then began to prepare for war, starting with verse 2. Now when Hezekiah saw that Sennacherib had come, that he intended to make war on Jerusalem, he decided with his officers and his warriors to cut off the supply of water from the spring which were outside the city, and they helped him. And so many people assembled and stopped all the springs and streams which flowed through the region, saying, why should the king of Assyria come and find abundant water? And he took courage and rebuilt all the wall that had been broken down and erected towers on it, and built another outside wall and strengthened the Milo in the city of David, and made weapons and shields in great number. Basically, one of their plans was, if we have an invading army, we're not going to supply them with water. So they stopped up all the springs and everything else except for the ones that were inside the city. Now, in 1880, two boys were swimming in a pool in Jerusalem, and there's a tunnel off the side of the pool, and they swam in there, and about 20 feet into the end of the tunnel, they found a plaque that nobody knows before and had writing on it. That was excited everybody. And the writing says, when the tunnel was driven through, and this was the way in which it was cut, while there were still axes, each man toward his fellow, and while there were still 3 cubits to be cut through, there was heard the voice of a man calling to his fellows, for there was an overlap in the rock on the right and on the left. And when the tunnel was driven through, the quarrymen hewed the rock, each man toward his fellow, axe against axe, and the water flowed from the spring toward the reservoir for 1,200 cubits, and the height of the rock above the heads of the quarrymen was 100 cubits. It's basically a document saying, here's how we did the tunnel. One group started on one side, one group started on another side, and they quarried. Kind of roughly estimating which way to go until they got close to each other, and by the sounds of the voice, they adjusted and met up with each other underneath the rock. That tunnel is 1,800 feet long. By the way, it says, this piece says there was 1,200 cubits, which if you've got 1.5 feet for a cubit, that comes out to 1,800 feet long, showing that that was the length in Hezekiah's day. But notice, the Bible mentions Hezekiah made preparations, plug up springs, diverted the water, and here we have the actual a piece documenting that's what they did, written in that day. Another interesting backup of some of the things stated in the Bible, and it's again part of Sennacherib. This is called Taylor's Prison. I don't know how well you can see it, but it's written with cuneiform writing. Really tiny writing on a big piece. It's a hexagon-shaped piece. And in that prism is Sennacherib's accounts of his rule. And so one of it is an account of his military campaign into Judah. It actually has Sennacherib's version of his invasion of Judah that we just started reading about. It says, as to Hezekiah the Jew, he did not submit to my yoke. I laid siege to 46 of his strong cities, walled forts, and to countless number of small villages in their vicinity, and conquered them by means of well-stamped earth ramps and battering rams, brought thus near the walls, combined with the attack by foot soldiers, using mines, breaches, as well as sapper works. I drove out of them 200,150 people, young, old, male and female, horses, mules, donkeys, camels, big and small cattle, beyond counting, and considered them booty. Himself I made a prisoner in Jerusalem, his royal residence, like a bird in a cage. I surrounded him with earthwork in order to molest those who were leaving his city gates. Now, what's absolutely fascinating about it, he talks about all the cities he conquered, how many people he got, and he had trapped Hezekiah. He never mentions conquering. He never mentions he actually took Jerusalem. Now, compare that to 2 Kings chapter 18. And we are going to read verse 13 through 17. Now in the 14th year of King Hezekiah, Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, came up against all the fortified cities of Judah and seized them. Then Hezekiah, king of Judah, sent to the king of Assyria at Lachish, saying, I have done wrong. Withdraw from me. Whatever you impose on me, I will bear. So the king of Assyria required of Hezekiah, the king of Judah, 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold. Hezekiah gave them all the silver which he had found in the house of the Lord and in the treasuries of the house, king's house. And at that time, Hezekiah cut off the gold from the doors of the temple of the Lord and from the doorposts which Hezekiah, king of Judah, had overlaid and gave it to the king of Assyria. Okay, and then the king of Assyria then sent Tartan and Rabsaris and Rabshakeh from Lachish to King Hezekiah with a large army to Jerusalem. So they went up and came to Jerusalem. And when they came up, they came and stood by the conduit of the upper pool, which is on the highway of the Fuller's Field. Now notice, like I said, Sennacherib never mentions he actually conquered Jerusalem. He did surround it. He only conquered the cities north of Jerusalem. And from the scriptures, we know why. If we go to 2 Kings chapter 19 and verse 32, 2 Kings 19, starting with verse 32, "Therefore, thus says the Lord concerning the king of Syria, he will not come into this city, nor shoot an arrow here there. And he will not come before it with a shield or throw up a siege ramp against it. But by the way he came, the same he will return. And he shall not come up to the city, declares the Lord. For I will defend this city to save it for my own sake and for my servant David's sake." Then it happened that night that the angel of the Lord went out and struck 185,000 in the camp of the Assyrians. And when the men rose in the morning, behold, all the men were dead. So Sennacherib, king of Syria, departed and returned to his home and lived at Nineveh. Well, amazing, isn't it? You have this huge, 185,000 soldiers. It's not a small amount. And you wake up in the morning, they're all dead. How did that happen? And most of these people back in those times tended to be kind of superstitious. And Sennacherib decided it was better off to leave now than before something else happened. And he ran back home. Now, did he mention that in his accounts of all his military victories? No. You do understand why he decided to skip over that little fact. But for the most part, what Sennacherib wrote down matches what we find in the scriptures. Now, if you notice, we mentioned that there was a town called Lachish, or Lachish, that was nearby. And there was a mention of a siege being held in Lachish. In fact, let's go back to 2 Chronicles 32. 2 Chronicles 32 and verse 9. It says, "After this, Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, sent his servants to Jerusalem. While he was besieging Lachish with all his forces with him against Hezekiah, king of Judah, and against all Judah who were at Jerusalem." So before he conquered Jerusalem, he was laying siege to Lachish. He decided, I got to take this big town. It was a big fortified city, a little bit southwest of Jerusalem. And we've got to take this one out first before we focus on Jerusalem itself. Well, the tell was identified as Lachish by a man named Albright in 1929. And this is an aerial photo. Fairly recent one, of that tell. It was excavated by James Leslie Starkey in 1932 to 1938, and then by the Tel Aviv University in 1973 to 1987. Lachish is regarded as the second most important city in southern kingdom of Judah, which would be why Sennacherib decided to take it out first before he went after Jerusalem itself. It enters the biblical narrative in the battle accounts of Joshua, Sennacherib, and Nebuchadnezzar also talks about having to deal with Lachish. William Deaver says the evidence is all there. The enormous sloping siege ramp, you can see it a little bit here on this side. But here's a more detail. The siege ramp's still there. The evidence of it is all there. The enormous sloping siege ramp thrown up against the city wall south of the gate. The double line of defensive walls, upslope and downslope. The iron-shod Assyrians battering rams that had breached the city wall at the highest points. The massive destruction with the fallen city. Virtually all the details of the Assyrian reliefs have been confirmed by archaeology. What they said is that when you go and you dig in here, you can find all the pieces of metal and stuff that were used in the siege that had fallen aside and got buried. It's exactly as the Assyrians said, which is also what the Bible says. See, the Assyrians wrote this big, huge relief, and I just want to show you this. It's a huge piece, and we don't have all of it. It goes around, wraps around that room. And it describes, in pictorial ways, Sennacherib's conquering. And including in that is, this is a depiction of the siege of Lachish, with battering rams being brought up on sloped siege walls to knock out the walls, the use of arrows, showing the whole battle going on there. See, this is the only siege ramp excavated in the Near East, and this one is constructed by the forces of Sennacherib in his 701 BC invasion of Judah. More than 1,000 iron arrowheads were found in the ramp, as well as chains for catching the battering rams. This ramp is depicted in Sennacherib's siege reliefs, with 5 battering rams ascending it. So if you get the whole, so the small picture, you get the whole picture, there's 5 battering rams going up against it. They found all this. It matches what the Bible talks about. And again, we have some evidence. Now, with Sennacherib, we got some more evidence that matches up with the Bible. Sennacherib, after he runs back to Assyria, doesn't live very much longer because he was killed. And in 2 Kings 19, and in verse 37, it came about that as he was worshiping in the house of Nisroch, his god, that Adram Amalek and Assirazer his killed him with a sword, and they escaped into the land of Ararat. And Esarhaddon, his son, became king in his place. Now, there's a plaque that actually is commemorates Esarhaddon's taking over rule. And that's been found. And from the translation by Luckenbill of his Chronicles, and it's found in Assyria, it says, in the month of Nishanu, on a favorable day, complying with their exalted command, I made joyful entrance into the royal palace, an awesome place, wherein abides the fate of kings. A firm determination fell upon my brothers. They forsook the gods and turned to their deed of violence, plotting evil to gain the kingship. They slew Sennacherib, their father. And this, by the way, is then referred to as a Nabonidus steal. And it says that Sennacherib was killed by Esarhaddon's brothers, who managed to escape. But Esarhaddon mentions that little fact. And it, by the way, it also confirms it was in the same, it also names the temple and everything else, and it's the same temple that's mentioned in the Bible. Now, another interesting piece are things that are called bullae. When a scroll is written, it'll be wound up into a cylinder, wrapped with a cord, and then the cords are tied, and what they would do is put a piece of soft wax on top of the knot. And then they would stamp it with the owner's stamp to say who that scroll belonged to. Be either soft clay, wax, or soft metal. The stamp was used to impress the seal to give notice of who's the owner of the scrolls. And that way, if the seal is missing, you knew somebody was in the scroll. And you knew somebody took it or had opened it up. Now, one location in Jerusalem is known as the House of Bullae because so many of these seals were found. The building was burnt by the Babylonians. Of course, the fire destroyed all the scrolls because they're paper, papyrus and that type. So none of those things survived. But the very fire that destroyed the scrolls also baked the seals and thus preserved them as fired clay. And there's an interesting thing because we find this one is the writing on it is that it's this, the bullae, the seal, of Gemara. And it was found in 1982, in a layer of Jerusalem that corresponds with its destruction in 586 BC. And the seal is marked Jemariah, the son of Shaphan. And it's going to only be the seal of the one who's mentioned in Jeremiah 36. So if we go to Jeremiah 36, and we're going to read verses 10 to 12. It says, then Baruch read from the work of the words of Jeremiah in the house of the Lord in the chamber of Jeremiah, the son of Shaphan, the scribe in the upper court at the entry of the new gate of the house, Lord's house, to all the people. Now when Micaiah, the son of Jeremiah, the son of Shaphan, had heard all the words of the Lord from the book, he went down to the king's house, took the scribes into the scribe's chamber, and behold, the officials were sitting there, Elamashiah the scribe, and Delilah, the son of Shemaiah, and Elnathan, the son of Abkor, and Jemiah, the son of Shaphan, and Zedekiah, the son of Hananiah, and all the other officials. So here's he mentioned. He's one of the scribes that were there that listened to Baruch read Jeremiah's scroll. And we jump down to verse 25. So even though Elnathan and Delilah and Jeremiah pleaded with the king not to burn the scroll, he would not listen to them. The king commanded Jehiamel, the king's son, Shariah, the son of Azrael, and Shelemiah, the son of Abdeel, to seize Baruch, the scribe, and Jeremiah, the prophet, but the Lord hid them. So he was one of those who had pleaded, he was one of the scribes, he says, don't destroy, this is God's word. He stood up. Now we don't have much record, but we have his seal. We have his personal seal, showing that he existed. There's another one that's even, I find even more fascinating. They found this in the same area. It's the seal of Baruch. The guy we just read about, Jeremiah's scribe. There's three lines on this bulle. It says, belonging to Baruch Hayadu, Baruch Hayo, the son of Nerahayu, the scribe. And the suffix Hayu was a common epithet attached to names in Judah, which meant blessed of Jehovah. So while the translations render it I-A-H, Baruch's father was Neraiah. Some texts drop it altogether. The bulla is now displayed in the Israel Museum in Jerusalem. But take a look at Jeremiah 6, 36, verse 16 again. Jeremiah 36, verse 16. When they heard all the words, they turned in fear to one another and said to Baruch, we shall surely report this to the words of the king. I was wanting the one that... verse 14. So Baruch, the son of Neriah, took the scroll in his hand and went to them. So I wanted verse 14, not 16. But it gives us his lineage. This one says the same lineage. You know, there's several of these seals. In one private collection has a fingerprint on the back, which is fascinating. It means we might actually have Baruch's own fingerprint preserved in a piece of clay. And the reason why I find these particularly fascinating is these are bulles of not people who, you know, these are not the kings and the princes or the major. These are side people, you know, people that were just mentioned as scribes or was, you know, the everyday, more common type people. Yeah, they were, you know, Baruch was working with Jeremiah. That's, you know, makes them a little more significant. But they're not really notable people. Now think about it. It would be like saying that, you know, 3,000 years from now, somebody finds your personal signature. You're saying, well, who am I? My signature happened the last 3,000 years. That's basically what happened here. Now, we don't have time to go through all of this, but one of the things I wanted to point out also is I found a list by one archaeologist. Now, you have to understand, he's fairly much a skeptic. He won't take evidence unless it's really, really solidly in place. But he made a list of the people in the Bible that he thinks is confirmed by archaeology. The list is 50 people long. Okay. For instance, in the Bible, we have names of five Egyptian kings. Shishak, Sho, Haraka, Necho, and Hapre. Okay, those are the names of the kings that are found in the Bible. There are actual archaeological finds that show the names of those kings. At the right time, right period, just like the Bible shows. We already talked about the Mesha steel. Now that confirms Moab's king. So there's another one. We have the in archaeology, they can find the names of some of the kings of Aram, where Damascus is at. And so Hadadezer, Ben-Hadad, his son, Haziel, his son, Ben-Hadad, his son, again, different Ben-Hadad, and Rezin are all found in archaeology at the right time, right place, mentioned just like the Bible says they were. Whole lineage of kings. In Israel, notice the list is really long of how many kings that they can match up with the Bible. There's mention of Omri, that was in Mishah's steel, plus in other spots. Ahab, Jehu, Joash, Jeroboam II, Mahanaim, Pekah, Shoa, and Sanballat is actually not a king but a governor, but he's also mentioned under the Persian rule, and they're all, the scriptural references are up there. Not going to take time to read them all, but they're all found in archaeology, different spots, sometimes multiply named. Judah, I had to reduce the font because we got so many things. The archaeology has confirmed, and this one kills people because they want David to be like King Arthur, where he's just mythological. But they found evidence, archaeological evidence that mentions David, several places. So David's been confirmed, Uzziah, Ahaz, Hezekiah, Manasseh, Hilkiah, Shaphan, the scribe, Hilkiah is the high priest, Azariah, the high priest again, Jeremiah, that's again that scribe that we talked about, Jehoiachin is a king, Shelemiah, again another official, Jehuachal is also an official, Pashur, who's the father of Jedidiah, and Jedidiah was also mentioned. These are all, some of these are just officials, but some of these are actual kings, and they all mentioned in the scriptures. And then you got Assyria, Tiglath-Pileser, Shalmaneser, Sargon, Sennacherib is mentioned, the guy who does the assassination, Adram Melech, and Esarhaddon are all mentioned in the scriptures, and you can find them in archaeology. Confirm that these people lived at the right proper time. Babylonian. The Bible mentions Merak Baladan, Nebuchadnezzar. Of course, we know very well. Nabal-Sarishkin was an official. Evil-Merodach. I always thought that was a weird name to give a king. But he's mentioned. And Belshazzar. He's the one who was partying in the with the temple stuff. They're all mentioned as being historically in archaeology. All confirmed as being there. 50 different people. Persia, Cyrus, Darius, Artaxerxes, and Darius. They're all confirmed as being the right kings in the right place, the right time. And the reason for mentioning all this is, again, not that archaeologists prove the Bible, But I want you to think about what it would take for you if you wanted to sit down and forge an ancient document. Because that's sometimes what people claim. Oh, the Bible was written during the Babylonian captivity. Well, getting the names of the kings during the Babylonian captivity probably wouldn't be that difficult. But how about getting all the other kings in the right time, in the right time frame? How about all the low officials that are sometimes mentioned and get them in the right place with the right names? I guess a little more difficult. It's quite a bit more difficult, actually, because records are not kept real well, and a lot of the stuff gets destroyed. So basically saying, okay, we're going to write a detailed document about, something that happened in the United States hundreds, 200 years ago without all our extreme records that we now gathered up. It'd be difficult to do. Yet this is what's been managed. We have a Bible that has these information. It's done accurately, and it's supporting evidence that the Bible is correct. It is what it claims to be. It was a record written during those times, and it's an accurate record. There's more confirmation than mere chance. And by the way, these 50 names are the ones here. This guy is absolutely confident about. It doesn't mean that's all they have. He gives a list of another seven that he's kind of somewhat sure. But he doesn't even put Baruch's seal in there. So I know there's more than that. There's lots more that are being confirmed. It's just that they're not real confident about it. Part of the problems are sometimes names are common. So you find a name and you say, yeah, it matches the name in the Bible, but is it the Bible character or not? You don't know. Not after all those years. But it's interesting. It's useful to us. Because we need to have confidence that the Bible that we have is God's Word. And that's what we had read for us in this morning's Bible reading, where God challenges, tell what happens in the future, but tell us also what happened in the past accurately. That's something mankind has not been able to do, not with reliable efforts. They try sometimes, but they always miss something. The Bible's always been shown to be accurate. So if you think about those things, if there's anyone here today who's not yet a child of God, there's no better time than now to become one. Those of you who are children of God would like the prayers of your brethren on your behalf. Again, we'll leave this time for you. Why don't you come forward with me, stand and sing the song selected.